We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover. Starting with local and the new arena.
Yeah, the Soto Blob. There are three arena designs floating around out there for the new third arena in the Soto area. When they were released, they posted them up on a website for people to take a look at. One was a very boring-looking oval. Another one was a very boring-looking square. And then there was the preferred design, which was a blob surrounded by stairs and awnings. Now, the public response to these three designs was that all of them were about as ugly as sin. Chris Hansen, after getting some public feedback, decided to make a tweak to the preferred design. He turned the blob into an orange blob surrounded by stairs and awnings. And now, of course, it's an eyesore. So I looked at it and I thought, okay, what happens in 10 years when bright orange is no longer a stylish color? Do we then just tear it down and build a new one?
Well, it'll be obsolete by then anyway.
Yeah, probably will be.
We need to have something that's state-of-the-art so we can be a world-class city. Haven't you been reading the papers?
Yeah, including a bright orange blob in Soto.
Yeah, because we already have a blob north of downtown, so we need one south of downtown to counteract it.
You're talking about the EMP?
Yes.
I guess since he's putting in a lot of money, it won't be one of the ones that's... has a sponsor, so it could be the Sun-Kissed Blob.
Oh, he'll sponsor it because they make money that way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. The Port of Seattle.
Yeah, the Port of Seattle this week was caught giving away taxpayer money. Now, there were two news items about it. One was six SeaTac tenants will get exclusive no-compete leases that include a break in rent. Port Commissioners John Crichton and Rob Holland were the big supporters of this proposal. The port would collect $8 million less in rent over 7 years from 11 restaurants operated by these six tenants. And these were the same businesses that received perks from the port in 2005 that included rent reductions, lower utility and storage fees, and construction reimbursements. Now, this led the FAA Minority Business Compliance Specialist to say, quote, this looks unfair or even discriminatory since 14 other SeaTac tenants won't get these special perks. Nevertheless, in September, all five port commissioners voted to pass the proposal. The proposal won't go into effect, however, until the FAA reviews it and rules on whether or not it can go through.
It would be fascinating to see whether the owners or senior management of some of the companies that operate those primarily chain restaurants have given money to the reelection campaigns of any of the port commissioners, because, frankly, that's a lot of how the port has operated in the past.
Yes, exactly. And the other news story about the port this week is that a state audit found that the port is giving away free parking at SeaTac. A faulty credit card machine, and there's some question about whether there are more faulty credit card machines that are working in the SeaTac garages, have cost taxpayers at least $400,000 and probably a lot more, because people, when they swipe their cards through these faulty credit card machines, they look like they're taking money off your card, but in fact they're not processing the charge.
Did they say exactly which machines those were?
They didn't say exactly.
Darn.
Since the auditors pointed out the problem, the port has said that it is trying to fix the machines, but it can't seem to get them fixed. New machines haven't been tested to make sure that they're operating properly, so it's an ongoing problem at the port. So here you go. Two more news stories showing problems with the port.
All right. Did they give any reason for why they're giving those businesses a break?
No, they gave no reason other than that the economic downturn has led to some airlines canceling their flights or moving to cheaper terminals at SeaTac, which means less traffic by some of those restaurants. But the problem here is that those 11 restaurants are not the only ones that have seen a downturn in their income. There are other restaurants as well that are not getting these cushy breaks that have also had less business.
Okay. All right. Moving along, a couple Democrats jumping ship this week.
Yeah, and this was a pretty widely expected move. Democratic State Senators Rodney Thom of Bellevue and Tim Sheldon of Potlatch have announced this week that they're going to join the Republican caucus in January in the state Senate. That means they'll be voting with Republicans and not with the Democrats. This gives the Republicans a majority instead of the one-vote Democratic majority that was expected to be in the state Senate. Rodney Tom did it, of course, because he will now be the Senate Majority Leader instead of Ed Murray, who would have been the Democratic Majority Leader. He's now exploring a run for Seattle Mayor. Rodney Tom proposed a power-sharing formula in the Senate whereby the Republicans get to chair the important committees like the Ways and Means Committee, which works on the budget, Health Care Committee, and Education. And the Democrats get to chair the less important committees like Parks and Natural Resources, the Environment Committee, Agriculture, etc. Of course, if the Democrats refuse to play, then the Republicans will have to grapple with tackling some very tough issues this session, like actually balancing the budget, putting together a transportation funding package, and, of course, the McCleary decision that says the state has to spend an extra $1 billion in order to adequately fund K-12 education.
Yeah, and given the template of the Republican passed Senate budget last year, when again, you had three Democrats, one of whom is no longer in the Senate, but these are the mm-hmm. other two that passed the Republican-sponsored budget last year. That budget took a lot more money out of social services and did essentially took raising revenue off the table compared to what the House had passed. And so it looks like we'll have that again confronting Governor Inslee.
Yeah, and if we compare this to what's going on in the House, where the Democrats, who have the majority, have split the Ways and Means Committee, which works on the budget, into two committees, one with an emphasis on looking at the revenue, it looks like they're going to try to raise revenue, whereas the state Senate, no.
By the way, a side note to this, Rodney Tom, the East Side quote-unquote Democrat, who actually was once a Republican, and he jumped to the Democrats 5 or 6 years ago, mm-hmm. And is now obviously jumping back, although he still claims to be a Democrat, just caucusing with the Republicans and giving the Republicans control of the Senate, is defending this action by saying he has helped create a bipartisan majority in the Senate. Now, it's bipartisan only in the sense that he and Senator Sheldon, who is sort of the most notoriously conservative Democrat in Olympia, have jumped ship and sided with the Republicans. But can we please reserve the use of the term bipartisan for when majorities of both caucuses have signed off on something, rather than you got one or two tokens who signed on to one party's agenda?
Yeah.
Because it's deeply misleading, and you know, the whole fetish in political media about, oh, it's bipartisan, therefore it must be good, is being badly exploited by people like this.
Mm. All right. Moving on, item this week from Publicola.
Interesting item from Publicola on what city council members who are going to be up for re-election in 2015, that's nearly 3 years from now, are doing to comply with new reforms that were passed this fall that prohibits them, and this law took effect on November 16th, from carrying over money from previous to the 2 year period before their election. So that, for example, somebody running for office in 2015 can't carry over any money from a previous election. They have to raise it after January 1st of 2013. Well, the existing council members, in their infinite legislative wisdom, grandfathered themselves, of course. But nonetheless, four city council members had to figure out what they were going to do with all the money they had left over from their previous successful re-election races, those being Sally Clark, Bruce Harrell, Tim Burgess, and Tom Rasmussen, all of whom were reelected without real serious competition in 2011. Well, let's see. We had Tom Rasmussen, who was unopposed after Sandy Coggs dropped out of the race in June, but nonetheless raised the most money of any city council candidate, and that's the second cycle in a row, I believe, that he's done that. He raised $300,000 in 2011, moved $45,000 from his 2011 campaign into his 2015 fund. He also transferred a little more than $10,000 to his office fund, which is something that council members can use on virtually any city office-related purpose, and then donated $30,000 to charities. Bruce Harrell, who is exploring a run for mayor, transferred $45,000 into his 2015 campaign on November 15th, because, of course, if he runs for mayor next year, he won't, if he loses, he won't lose his seat. He'll still be on the council. He put $10,000 into the office fund and gave $1,500 to the Central Area Senior Center. Sally Clark transferred about $29,000 from her 2011 surplus to her 2015 campaign and donated $21,000 to various charities. And then Tim Burgess, who has already announced that he's running for mayor, refunded $75,000 to donors, probably in anticipation of his mayoral campaign, because candidates who run for an office other than the one they're currently holding have to get permission from each prior donor to use their dollars in a new campaign. Burgess also contributed $25,000 to the state Democrats, probably to reinforce the idea that he is actually a Democrat, which a lot of people in the city are dubious about, since he's by far the most conservative of the city council members. And all of this overall basically is an exceptionally clear demonstration of what the problem is, that these folks have so much money left over from their previous campaigns that they have a huge head start on any contributor, setting aside all the other advantages that incumbents have in fundraising and name recognition and so forth. It's why it is so difficult to defeat a city council person, no matter how good or poor a job that they do. And again, also is yet another argument for an initiative that looks may well be on the 2013 ballot that would elect the majority of city council members by district, which would enable people to counteract some of those fundraising advantages.
All right. Also this week, the Obama administration coming out and saying they're going to respect the reefer.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're going to respect the reefer. What they say is that in Washington and Colorado, the two states that had passed marijuana legalization initiatives in November, that they're going to leave street-level pot users alone, so that you're not going to have federal agents busting in your door because somebody smelled a funny odor out on the sidewalk. What they have not said is that they're going to leave the states alone, and certainly under the initiative for Washington State, growers still and distributors are still face state sanctions. So that has not actually been legalized, except for the structure, if you want to call it that, and a few people do, around medical marijuana provision. But that, you know, the whole Garden Collective and that sort of stuff, which there is a ton of confusion around. That's another of the issues that Olympia is going to have to look at in January. But, the real question here is, if the state passes regulations in the next year, which outgoing Governor Gregoire has said they're looking to do as quickly as they can, but it will take a while. As soon as they pass regulations saying how this newly legal substance can actually legally be distributed, whether it's to retail outlets or whatever other system they cook up, the question at that point is whether the Obama administration will either go after the outlets or whether they will go after the state for administering that system. That is the real question coming out of the initiative this time. There's also a question of whether the Obama administration will join any legal challenges to the legality of the initiative due to the conflict between state and federal law, and that also is still an open question.
Yeah. What I thought was kind of interesting with Obama's talk with Barbara Walters, in which he said that he was not going to pursue people who use marijuana. What I thought was interesting is that he said Congress had not yet passed a law that would legalize marijuana. And I thought the use of the words "not yet passed a law," I thought that was very interesting, because it indicates that he's thinking it's inevitable that they will eventually have to legalize it. I found that very interesting. It, you know, of course, as Job said, you know, this has nothing to do with actual federal policy and what the Justice Department is going to do. And we've seen through 4 years of the Obama administration that the Justice Department pursuing medical marijuana dispensaries in the state of California, where it's legal for people to have medical marijuana.
And other states as well.
And so, you know, this basic, whatever Obama says in terms of what he thinks Congress will eventually do doesn't have any real impact on what federal policy is. However, I found it very interesting and a little bit hopeful that here you have the president indicating that he feels Congress, deep down, that he feels Congress will eventually legalize it.
Yeah, and, you know, for anybody who follows this issue closely, that's clearly where the arc is going. And
yeah.
there's very few things out there that seem that they would be likely to reverse that trend. A majority of Americans now favor legalization of marijuana, at least in some polls. And it's obviously been moving steadily in that direction over the last several years.
And it's a generational thing. People who are under 50 tend to be the folks who favor it more highly, and people over 50 less so. So it's interesting. It's one of those It's one of these interesting issues where we stand on the cusp of seeing things really change in a big way.
Yeah, but the caveat, which I was about to get to, is there are any number of issues on which the majority opinion of the American public is not reflected in laws that are made by Congress. And so, you know, the idea that history is inevitably moving in this direction, number one, it's not necessarily going to happen unless there's a strong push from the public rather than
people
just polling results.
Express and, how you feel.
And number two, for however long that it takes, every year that it happens, there are still tens, hundreds of thousands of people going to jail for nonviolent offenses and having their lives ruined over these idiotic laws.
Yeah, and so it's very important for people not just to express how you feel, but to go out and work for change.
All right. Moving on to national, starting with the school massacre.
Yeah, this week, actually yesterday, some very grim news in Connecticut. 27 dead in an elementary school in Newton, Connecticut, most of them kindergartners. It was the second worst mass murder in U.S. history, the worst being the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007, where 32 people died.
And in a lot of measures, I think emotionally, this one was actually the worst because you know, people react differently when it's 5 or 6 year olds than they do when it's college students.
Yeah, exactly. And so it kind of has led me to ask, you know, is this finally the death of 5 and 6 year old children going to lead to a discussion, a national discussion on gun control? And will Congress finally decide to renew the assault weapons ban? Because, you know, you can't easily kill 27 people, children, adults, whomever, in such a short period of time with just a shotgun in your hand. You know that this guy had semi-automatic weapons, weapons.
The various guns rights trolls that were on the internet yesterday morning initially reacting to this, and one of the things that came up in several of the comments was, yeah, well, there was an incident this morning in China where a guy with a knife came in and attacked 22 people. Well, yes, but as it turns out, he didn't kill any of them, and that's the difference. So assault weapons bans, banning the high-capacity magazines, which are a common thread in a number of these recent massacres. But the thing is that there isn't the political will to do this right now in Congress at all. It's not even close. Even getting hearings on this, it's not even, the Senate and House Judiciary Committees. The Senate committee is judged by Patrick Leahy, who actually scores pretty well on the NRA's scorecard from Vermont, and then a representative from Virginia chairs the House committee. This is the same guy who has proposed legislation to require presidential candidates to show their birth certificates. It's not going to happen in Congress right now. And the only way that something more than a conversation or a few days or a week or two of pundits wringing their hands until we do get into last-minute Christmas shopping and people forget about this, the only way serious change is going to happen is if people start caring about these issues between the massacres.
Yeah.
You know, if it's been a lot of years since gun reform or gun control advocates have been a meaningful political force in this country. And until people start making this a primary issue that they care about between crises, so that when the inevitable next massacre does happen, and they seem to be coming more and more frequently, I mean, we had the mall shooting in Oregon just a few days ago. When something like this does happen that brings it into the media and focuses people's attention, people who are politically organized are ready to take advantage of that. Because otherwise, there's no reason for lawmakers to put themselves out there. I mean, just because it's good public policy, that's not what gets legislation passed.
They have to get pressure from their constituents, from people in their districts.
So once again, if you care about this, don't just talk about it. Get out there and be active.
Yeah.
It actually applies to just about every issue.
Yes, it does.
All right. Let's move on then. The Federal Trade Commission coming out with a report.
Yeah, the Federal Trade Commission issued a report this week on child privacy and mobile apps. The vast majority of mobile apps collect data. that are aimed towards children, because there are many, many more of them now aimed towards children, and there are devices specifically manufactured for children to use. I think one of the most popular toys this Christmas season for people to buy is a tablet designed specifically for children. The vast majority of those mobile apps collect data on children without their parents' knowledge or consent. The FTC reviewed 400 of the most popular children's apps, and the apps collected phone numbers and the precise location of mobile devices. They also displayed ads to children. Even when the apps themselves said that they contained no advertising, they still displayed advertising to the children who use them. And this review, I want to point out, too, is part of a push by the FTC to update its regulation, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which has been in place for about a decade, a little bit over a decade. That regulation is desperately in need of being updated in light of new technology, the fact that it's much easier for children to get online now, and because now there are mobile devices that may include special new technology like facial and voice recognition capabilities and data collection by advertising agencies. Most tech companies, of course, are against any changes to the regulations, and that includes companies like Apple, Facebook, Google, and Viacom. So, again, that's another issue where parents should be paying attention and should be expressing how they feel to the Federal Trade Commission and pushing for stronger protections on data collection when it comes to their children. I think, and you know, these tech companies, they always say, well, we don't want them to change the regulations because strengthening the regulations means that we won't be able to collect data on anybody, not just on children.
Aww.
And and my response to that is, well, boo-hoo. You know, the fact that you collect data on me isn't something that makes me feel all warm and fuzzy, you know. So I think people should be pushing for more online privacy for everyone in general, not just children.
All right. Also out this week, a report about Gulf War Syndrome.
Yeah, a new scientific paper was published in the journal Neuroepidemiology showing that U.S. troops in the first Gulf War, we're talking from 1990 to 1991, for those of you who don't remember the first Gulf War,
there have been so many since.
Yeah, could have been exposed to nerve agents. Data taken from meteorological and intelligence sources show that U.S. bombs dropped on chemical weapons sites in Muthanna and Fallujah in January of 1991 could have sent sarin gas high into the atmosphere, where it would have been blown far out of Iraq, possibly into Saudi Arabia, where U.S. troops were based, and that sarin gas could have fallen out of the atmosphere and exposed a lot of U.S. troops. Now, Gulf War Syndrome has affected nearly half of the 700,000 U.S. troops deployed in 1990 and 1991, and that's a far higher number than you would expect if you're just looking at statistics for post-traumatic stress disorder, given that the first Gulf War was over in a matter of weeks, not years, as the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It was several months, but still. I think it was three or four months. But it's not
Which
just
is
U.S.
About,
troops.
About 12 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, it's not just U.S. troops have been affected by this. Also, it's worth remembering that there were huge numbers of cancers and malformed babies and such in the civilian Iraqi population after that war
after
as well.
The first Gulf War,
going on through for the next number of years as well.
All right. And finally, briefly on National, a survey about climate change.
You may be wondering, with all the massive numbers of people in this country who apparently think climate change is not happening, or is happening but is not caused by humans at all, what exactly they think is causing all this strange weather that's going on around the world. Because, you know, understanding that might lead to creating, addressing those concerns and creating the political will to actually, really do something. Public Religion Research Institute and Religious News Service put out a poll and surveyed people who have those beliefs, and 36% of those surveyed and 66% of evangelical Christians evoke the New Testament apocalypse, which is to say the end of the world, in explaining all the recent climate change data. That's not particularly something that you can argue with, and all the facts and figures in the world are not going to make a difference to somebody who thinks it's God's will that, that humanity be destroyed. I don't know what to do about this, but it's really a very, very frightening survey, and it really underlines the ease with which the fossil fuel industry and various other parties that have had a financial interest in stoking the flames of the climate denial industry can play to people's prejudices and ignorance around this, frankly, because if you think it's the hand of God and there's nothing we can do, you know, then why do anything?
Mm-hmm. I think that's why people say that that's the reason, is because then they don't have to do anything.
Yeah, and it's amazing how many people have gone directly from it's not happening to it's happening, but it's God's will, as a way of avoiding accountability or the need to make any changes in their own lives, regardless of the conclusion. Yeah.
It's not man-made. It's God's will. Syria.
Syria, yes. This week, the U.S. declared the Nusra Front a terrorist group. There's a little problem with that, however. The Nusra Front, which has ties to al-Qaeda in Iraq, very strong ties to al-Qaeda in Iraq, turns out it's the most effective and disciplined unit in the Free Syrian Army. In fact, it's so good at taking over territory that they have no trouble getting new recruits and bringing in, actually stealing troops from other Syrian military units.
And troops and young men who might not share their ideological beliefs but just want to be effective.
But just want to be part of a disciplined unit that works well. The Nusra Front is actually getting a lot of sympathy from folks in the Syrian resistance because of the U.S. having put it on the terrorist list. A lot of people are saying congratulations to the Nusra Front, and they're actually getting more recruits just because, well, the people in the Syrian resistance are a little bit angry at the U.S.
And when have we heard this play out before in the Arab Spring, and for that matter in the long history of U.S. support and then disavowal of dictators? Is, yes, absolutely, there needs to be regime change. We need to get rid of this horrible dictator, but only if it's somebody that we like.
Yes. I also want to talk about the Tazreen factory fire in Bangladesh. This happened a week or two ago, a fire in an illegal garment factory that killed at least 112 people. After Walmart said that they had no connection at all to the factory, investigators in Bangladesh have found documents in the building that show the factory was producing garments for Walmart, Sears, Disney, and the European chain store C&A. Bangladesh is the world's second leading manufacturer of cheap clothing for the Western markets behind China. Young women in Bangladesh earn less than $45 per month, working 60 to 70 hour weeks in these fire trap buildings in the garment industry in Bangladesh. In the past decade, garment retailers like Walmart, Sears, Gap, and Nike have set up a self-policing, industry-paid inspection system for factories that produce their clothing in order to address concerns by activists that that workers in developing countries are being exploited by these large retailers. The fire and a recent factory fire in a factory in Pakistan where at least 262 workers were killed proved that the industry just can't police itself, and that consumers, particularly during this holiday season, you need to vote with your cash. You need to reject the ultra-cheap clothing at these outlets because it's made at the cost of the lives of young women in developing nations.
By the way, if you're wondering why Walmart and Disney and all these other companies use these factories, I just did some very quick mental math. Don't hold me to it on what those wages are. Mm-hmm. I think it comes out to about 6 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find my back articles at mariatomchik.com.